Beyond Pistons, your daily Detroit Pistons podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
What's happening? Welcome to the Locked On Pistons podcast. This is your host, Matt Shook, and this is the episode for Thursday, February 8th. And today we're going to be looking into the business side of Blake Griffin to the Pistons. But you can find me on Twitter at Matt_Shook, S-C-H-O-C-H, another underscore after that, and also the Locked On Pistons Twitter feed at Locked On Pistons. And find us on Facebook as well, like that page at Locked On Pistons-Matt Shook. And today we're going to be recapping Wednesday's win against the Brooklyn Nets, and I'm going to have a nice chat with Bill Shea, the senior reporter from Cranes Detroit, covering the business side of pro sports in the city. We're going to be talking about the Blake Griffin bump, the Pistons business particulars overall, and also an update on the MLS situation in Detroit, and Bill's thoughts as well on the new Lions coach, Matt Patricia, we'll be talking about too. A little programming note, today is the trade deadline at 3 p.m. Eastern, so if there is something done big, obviously we'll put something up tonight or as soon as we possibly can. If nothing huge happens, we'll kind of come up with the regular Friday podcast, looking ahead to the weekend and recapping what didn't happen for the Pistons and around the league as well. But the Pistons got the fifth straight win on Wednesday night, 115-106 against the Brooklyn Nets at home at Little Caesars Arena in downtown Detroit. 25 points and 7 assists for Blake Griffin, 11 points in the fourth quarter as he dominated late. The Pistons are now 27-26, just percentage points behind the Philadelphia 76ers for 8th place in the Eastern Conference, but just 4 games behind the Cleveland Cavaliers for 3rd place. So just a jumbled mess of teams in the Eastern Conference there. And as I've said, the goal for these next week or so isn't just to get back into that 8-team playoff spot, but by the All-Star break next week, but to get in there with room to spare if possible. The Pistons are home on Friday against the Clippers on ESPN, and what should be an emotional night for a few of those guys, former Pistons, obviously. And then at Atlanta on Sunday, home versus New Orleans without Boogie on Monday, and then home versus Atlanta again on Wednesday. So that could be 4 wins, should be at least 3 of 4, however way you slice it, and a chance to get back into the playoff top 8 with, like I said, a little bit of room to spare because they might need it later on with some tough road trips and tough matchups coming up after the All-Star game. But 19 points for Stanley Johnson, who was magnificent again, 15 points for Ish Smith. But the big statistical anomaly, 17, I got not much of an anomaly this day, but a statistical standout, I guess I should say, 17 points and 27 rebounds for Andre Drummond, who had the best rebounding output for any player in the NBA this season. I mean, those are incredible. Those are worm-like numbers that Drummond had. Drummond and Blake getting a lot of love on SportsCenter these days as well, which is something we'll talk about with our guest, Bill Shea, a little bit later. Not that SportsCenter is incredibly relevant anymore, but it's kind of a nice barometer of your team's Q rating, which you may not care about as a fan, but your owner, Tom Gores, certainly does. Andre was not so good in the first half. He looked a little bit tentative. It seemed like all he was really doing was rebounding, not finishing at the rim very well, and he continues to not protect the rim all that well at times too. People are challenging him at both ends of the court and having a lot of success at it, but he was better in the second half, very active in that third quarter, had 11 rebounds alone in the third quarter, off the bench, 13 points for Langston Galloway. He hit some shots early as the Pistons gained control after a bit of a slow start that they had in the first quarter. The Pistons only played 8 guys, in part because of the Willie Reed suspension. Apparently, Dwight Bikes was available. Reed's going to be suspended for 5 more games, by the way, after the All-Star break. He'll be coming back. But Dwight Bikes apparently was available, but did not get off the bench for Stan Van Gundy. And the other third part of that trade, in addition to Griffin and Reed for the Pistons, Bryce Johnson. He was sent down to Grand Rapids earlier on Wednesday for the Nets. Alan Crabb, he was a dog all night long, 34 points from the 25-year-old former Cal Golden Bear, including 19 points in the fourth quarter for Kenny Atkinson's Nets. The Nets shot 17 of 51. That's right, 51 shots from three-point land, and the Nets lost their 4th game in a row and 8 of 9. I don't know about you, but I said this before on the podcast a couple months ago, but watching a team shoot 51 three-pointers, there's something to be said for some of those offensive possessions, but other times it's just like, wow, you guys are just jacking it up and not really completely fan-friendly in a lot of ways. But I wanted to clarify kind of the way I talked about the Brooklyn Nets on Wednesday's podcast. This team is really bad and is years and years away from winning, mostly because they sacrificed those high draft picks these last few years in a historically awful Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett trade with Boston. But that doesn't mean you can just roll out the balls and beat them, as we saw on Wednesday night. Coach Kenny Atkinson, he's a Mike D'Antoni disciple and was an assistant coach under him. And he's building one of those freewheeling three-point shooting teams. And that in and of itself makes them a difficult matchup at times. And in theory, you could lose to a team like that if they get hot on any given night. But they don't have enough talent to do that with any kind of consistency. But given the play that this bombs away style, first of all, it's different than a lot of things you see on a night-and-night-in basis. So it's something you have to prepare for. And then you have to give extra defensive effort to get out on shooters and to hustle a lot. And it really sucks to play them defensively. Again, this is an awful team and you should definitely win, but you need to play hard. You can't just roll in and be talented and roll out. The Pistons didn't do that for the first 6 minutes of this game, but then they did. And when it came down to it, they didn't have much trouble doing what they wanted to do, especially in the half court on both sides of the court, which much of the credit going to that for fourth quarter Blake Griffin, who dominated late. You might expect to see that many times down the stretch in this season for the Pistons, particularly against some of these awful teams, many of whom are actively trying to lose as an organization. So hopefully this might be the kind of the last spring of widespread NBA tanking with the new lottery system being imposed next year, which gives less benefit for teams to tank because of the lottery isn't as weighted towards the bottom of the standings going forward. But not that Brooklyn's tanking, as I incorrectly mentioned, by the way, on yesterday's podcast. Brooklyn isn't tanking. They're just really awful. But also, like I said, a real pain in the ass to play, and the Pistons found that out on Wednesday. It's an interesting team to keep an eye on in terms of philosophies in the NBA. And again, they don't have enough talent to be good for a while, but are they part of kind of an NBA revolution with all these spread you out and shoot all night long? Or will they always just be kind of a bad imitation of D'Antoni's Rockets? So something to think about. I mean, like Stan Van Gundy said in accordance to the Blake Griffin trade, talking about how you don't want to just get all perimeter guys and get the third-rate perimeter guys because everybody's trying to get them. You might as well zig when everyone else is zagging. So something to think about when you're thinking about the Brooklyn Nets' future. But up next, we're going to be talking to Bill Shea of Cranes Detroit, my former colleague from the Port Huron days. But we're going to be talking about the business outlook of the Blake Griffin deal and the Pistons overall as well. But speaking of business, if your company is interested in men between the ages of 18 and 44, then your company should be sponsoring this podcast. Locked On Pistons is listened to by 98% men and 80% between the ages of 18 to 44. So if you want men 18 to 44, this is your spot. Plus, our rates are reasonable. So email me at matt_shook, S-C-H-O-C-H, at yahoo.com to find out more.
Yes!
Now, in a second here, we're going to be joined by Bill Shea of Cranes Detroit, but I wanted to preface the interview. I mentioned a couple times that he was a semi-pro quarterback. He actually was kind of he was the third-string quarterback for the Port Huron Pirates back when I was writing about them for the Port Huron Times-Herald and the Great Lakes Indoor Football League, kind of a ragtag group of, you know, a minor professional sports league that played in McMoran Arena. And Bill was kind of the communications guy slash third string quarterback for them. He grew up playing some football, was a pretty good quarterback as well. But he was kind of doing a little bit of writing for them. And I think he might have even published a book about that or put together maybe a self-published book. I don't really know the details of it. I'll ask Bill about that, but maybe follow him on Twitter and reach out to him if you want to read it. It's some interesting stuff because it's, as you can imagine, some brawling, drunken behavior of the Port Huron Pirates. And Bill's a really good writer. He's a great read, especially when he's writing about things that obviously he enjoys writing about. And some of the offbeat stuff like that is interesting to read from Bill's perspective. So without further ado, here's Bill Shea. You can find him on Twitter at Bill_Shea19 and check him out there. And thanks to Bill for joining us. And here's the interview.
And now we're being joined by Bill Shea, senior reporter for Cranes Detroit, covering the business of sports in Detroit and former professional football player for the Port Huron Pirates, my former colleague in the Blue Water area. But Bill, thanks for taking the time today to talk to us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, Bill, you had a story that came out over the weekend in Cranes Detroit about Blake Griffin, kind of looking at the business side of him coming over to the Detroit Pistons, titled Griffin Gives Pistons New Marketing Sizzle. Now, as a business reporter, what are the kind of things when you maybe look back on that story a couple weeks from now or follow up with it in a month or something like that, what are some of the indicators that you're looking at other than maybe just pure attendance numbers to see if this is working, if there's a good amount of buzz coming in for the Pistons with the trade?
Well,
I think you're right that after the butts and seats, there's a few other metrics you want to look at, some of which are a little harder to get at than others. But you can check out their social media numbers. Are they getting more buzz? Is there more conversation going on, not only in social media, but in traditional media as well? Are they getting headlines? Are they getting highlights on SportsCenter? You know, some of that's anecdotal, but that does add up over time towards the, you know, the immediate value of the brand. And then there's other things you can look at. If you see, you know, new sponsorships popping up, more interest from on the corporate side of things, sometimes the teams will put out, you know, screaming press releases. They've signed a new 10-year deal with Acme Widgets to sponsor such and such, or, you know, things like that. Sometimes they'll make a big deal out of. Other times, you know, you got to do a little bit of rooting around and you find out, yeah, it's, you know, Blake Griffin's led to more attendance, more, you know, TV and radio ratings, things like that. Advertisers will want to get back on the Pistons bandwagon. And, you know, there'll be local sponsorships, you know, there'll be some spillover perhaps as they get better to other players, pick up deals and things like that. So there's a real ripple effect that can happen when you get a blockbuster trade that works out for you.
Now, the narrative about the Pistons, especially early on in the season with the first few games at Little Caesars Arena, were the empty seats. And we've all talked about that ad nauseum so far this year. But your story mentioned how the Pistons are 19th in attendance, probably not where they want to be with the new arena, but, you know, pretty mediocre as far as those things go. Do you find that the NBA numbers, I mean, was that kind of a laughable stat in some ways? I mean, are the NBA numbers pretty legit as far as believed by the, you know, the sports business reporter community, or is that one of those leagues where you can fudge it quite a bit?
I think all of the leagues and all of them doing a little bit differently. Like in college football, when you see Michigan's huge football statistics, that's not just the people in the stands. If I remember right, that's marching band and press box and all sorts of other numbers that they legally and ethically are allowed to include in their attendance. And when you get to stuff like the NBA, you know, there are the baseline is your season ticket sales. That's the first, you know, 2 or 5 or 10,000 tickets that are sold, and they're sold for the year. So that's your minimum baseline attendance. And then you have your single game tickets, you know, the people walking up that, you know, they got Blake Griffin, I'm going to go to Thursday's game or Saturday's game. You just might see a spike there. And then there's the group sales that are, you know, company outings or schools or groups and things like that will buy 20 or 50 or 100 tickets. And then you have your corporate sponsorship giveaways, whether that's Quicken Loans or, you know, Acme Widgets again buys 50 tickets or gets 50 tickets as part of a package deal or a sponsorship deal that they have, and they give those to clients or they give those to their employees. You know, those are bought tickets. Sometimes they're giveaway tickets, but they do count towards that overall attendance. And a lot of times season ticket holders don't show up. A lot of times those group sales don't show up. So if you see that they're averaging 17,000 or whatever it might be, and you go to the game and it's half full in a 20,000 seat arena, there might be 10,000, there might be 7,000, and you look at the box score and you're like, well, that doesn't really jive with what I saw. Well, that's why. And those tickets were sold or given away, but those people weren't necessarily coming through the turnstiles. And that's true across all of the leagues pretty much.
But along those lines, you know, the opening night was apparently a sellout against the Charlotte Hornets. And I just assumed that when Blake Griffin came on, there were 4 days or so leading up to his debut on Thursday. And then we find out that Thursday game wasn't a sellout. There's still all the empty seats. Rod Beard of the Detroit News on Twitter was one of the guys who covers the team that said he wasn't surprised by that you got to win a bunch of games consistently to get the fans out. But was I naive for thinking that, oh, well, of course, Blake Griffin's first game, it's a Thursday night, it's not a Monday or Tuesday night, of course that will be a sellout and that will be a loud arena, and that it was a little bit louder, it was a little bit more fans in the stands. But do you think, were you surprised that that wasn't the blockbuster ticket that maybe it could have been, you know, for a playoff game or something like that?
I'm not completely surprised. I wouldn't have been shocked if they did sell it out. But that it was, I think they traded for him on Tuesday, The game was Thursday, if I remember right. So you had a fairly short window to turn it around. They certainly captured the news cycle. I mean, people were aware. I think maybe had that first game been a Saturday or Sunday, they probably would have come closer or actually sold it out. And you know, if it was maybe, if it was the Clippers they were playing or the Cavaliers or you know, a first-tier opponent rather than Memphis, maybe it would have been a little bit more interesting, you know, but they had lost 8 games coming in. They have struggled with attendance. I think maybe the newness of the arena has worn off a little bit with the diehards. A lot of people who wanted to see that place have seen it now. So I'm not particularly shocked that it didn't sell out. 5 years ago, 10 years ago, it absolutely would have, you know, if they were still at the Palace, it would have sold out. And they're also in that transition period of switching geography from the Palace to Little Caesars Arena, where their season ticket base and the people that are going to buy a ton of walk-up tickets, that geography of where those people live is going to shift a little bit because, you know, you've shifted 30-some miles. And where your arena is, you're going to lose some of those northern suburb, you know, South Genesee County folks. I think you're going to get more people from a more, you know, you're going to get more downtown residents and some of the nearer suburbs are going to come in. But it's a little bit of a transition time, I think, for kind of a mediocre team to get that transition in. And people may just not trust this team as well. You know, they haven't been a good team in a decade. And when they are a good team, they sell out the arena every night. They'll lead the NBA in attendance. They prove that at the Palace multiple times. But when they're not good, people don't come. You know, that's true for every sports team around, but the Pistons seem to have a thinner margin of error than, you know, even the Lions do when they're not particularly good. I mean, obviously it's two different sports, but when the Pistons are not winning, people are not going except for a real, you know, cadre of a few thousand people.
And that's one of the things they talked about at the beginning of the year with the attendance problems, that the you know, I think it was January of last year that the official announcement came down that they'd be playing downtown in the Red Wings Arena this year. Let's say that for whatever reason they did have 2 or 3 years of lead up time before the public, you know, and the public knew for multiple years. What could they have done? What is it, like partnerships with Detroit businesses, or maybe more in the schools and the neighborhoods type of stuff? Or like you said, some of those, maybe the downriver communities that would have more access to downtown Detroit as opposed to Oakland County. What are some of the things that they could have done if they had more time to get more people in there?
I think you touched on some of the big points. You would have had 2 or 3 years of relationship building and trust building. Now, obviously winning cures most problems with professional sports teams. That's the first thing that, you know, they were trying to take care of it, but they simply haven't really done it to the degree that fans expect. But if you had 2 or 3 years of lead time, you would have built those business relationships with downtown and in different communities geographically versus, you know, being up in Auburn Hills. So you would have had some time, you know, more time to sell to new audiences, basically. You know, there would have been more branding time by the team, by its media partners, because the Little Caesars Arena has been a Red Wings project since before it was even official, you know, that it was going to actually happen. You know, I've been writing about this potential arena for a dozen years now, and it was a Red Wings thing, and it was that fan base devoted, you know, obviously with a long successful history with that team. You know, well, the Pistons had kind of fallen into the doldrums. So yeah, and they probably would have built their new headquarters by now. It probably would have opened along the same time as the arena did. So you would have had the full Detroit relocation process finished and been the actual Detroit Pistons again. And I think that certainly would have helped them. People don't realize, you know, these teams are not huge businesses. There aren't thousands of employees and hundreds of sales staff. You know, it's a relatively small, it's a couple hundred people work for them across the whole organization. So it's, you know, when you have less than a year, you have, you know, 9 months or whatever to begin that transition process to sell to new audiences it's only a handful of people doing that, and you're trying to sell to your old audience and try to get a new audience. So it's a lot of pressure on a relatively small number of people to make that transition. I think you're absolutely right in that, you know, with two or three more years lead time, might have been a little bit different story in terms of attendance.
Now, before I let you go, Bill, I wanted to touch on a couple of the other quick sports topics around Detroit, as you've got your hand in all of it these days. The MLS coming to Nashville in 2019, and I believe Miami is announcing that they're 2019 as well. From what you understand, is and Sacramento is still in the mix. I think they're possibly the front runners for possibly another one in 2019, but I'm not exactly clear on where that stands. Is Detroit on track for maybe being a front runner for the next wave in 2020? Is that the most realistic possibility, you think, at this point?
At this point, the conventional wisdom is if Sacramento can get its ownership situation shorted out, the feeling was they were the next market that would be awarded the second expansion market in this round. And then there's two more cities that MLS will award later this year, probably in December, with the front runners being Cincinnati and Detroit, because they were two of the four finalists along with Nashville and Sacramento for this round, for the total of four cities. If Detroit doesn't get this second market and it goes to the round for the final two, they rejoin the eight cities that weren't amongst the original 12 finalists. Maybe some of those drop out. Maybe some of them get better bids. I think Major League Soccer was a little taken aback by Detroit's decision to scrap a soccer-specific stadium and instead use Ford Field. Maybe they come around to that. Don Garber, the commissioner, has made some noise about, maybe we need to look at NFL stadiums as we get bigger crowds and things like that. Maybe 20,000 seats isn't big enough. So Detroit's got a real, real shot. I mean, they've got three billionaires behind the bid in the Fords, Dan Gilbert and Tom Gores. So I think the odds are decent that we end up with an MLS team by the end of this year.
Well, I hope it happens, and I also hope that MLS continues to say no to those guys and says, hey, why don't you build a nice outdoor stadium? I mean, this is a summer sport. I can't imagine sitting in Ford Field in the middle of January, or the middle of June and July. I'd rather be outside, just like soccer was meant to be played, in my opinion. But Bill, I know you're a football guy. You played football coming up as a quarterback. And like I said, a cameo with the Port Huron Pirates Indoor Football League when we worked together in Port Huron, the glory days. But so you're well-versed, and being a Cleveland guy, you can somewhat relate to the plight of the Detroit sports fan, especially the football lore. Big news for the Lions, Matt Patricia coming on board. What do you think of the hire, and what's these next few years bring for the Lions? I mean, should we start planning the Super Bowl parade pretty soon, or wait maybe another week or so?
Well, I like the hire, and what I really like about it is Detroit, I think, clearly wanted Matt Patricia from the start, and they got their guy. And that doesn't often happen with the Lions. You know, they have a history of not getting the guy, whether it's a coach or a player or a front office executive that they want, and they did. And they did in the case of Bob Quinn. They wanted him, and they got him. So from that off-the-field perspective, things have turned around a little bit for Detroit. I think Patricia's walking into a turnkey situation. Like you said, I'm a Clevelander. I know what nihilism is like when it comes to the NFL and just the endless losing and being the Charlie Brown of the NFL. But I'm not a Lions fan. I do enjoy covering the team and the situation, but because I'm removed a couple paces, I really think this team is a lot closer than people in Detroit realize. I think they are two or three players away, and from the right schemes and the right play calling, away from being a postseason contender. Whether that translates into a Super Bowl, that is really hard to get. You know, it's hard to get there. Not that many. You know, there's still four teams that have never been there, including the Lions. It's hard to make that final jump. But everything I've read and heard about Patricia, he's a smart guy. I think he's a unique guy out of the Belichick tree. He was very trusted. Belichick's a defensive guy, always has been, and he trusted Patricia with his defense. You know, they went to five, six Super Bowls together. They won three. The resume is there. So I'm very optimistic about what Matt Patricia can do with his, and it seems like he's going to let Stafford and Cooter do their thing. That it, you know, it mostly works. Let's not mess with a relatively good thing. Get a couple more players, get some pass rushers and maybe another linebacker. And this team could make a postseason run before people realize and get a damn playoff game at Ford Field for the first time ever actually involving the Lions. There's been playoff games there, but it wasn't their game. So, and I think this city will go absolutely bananas bonkers to, you know, if the Lions won a playoff game at Ford Field, it would be pandemonium in downtown Detroit.
Yeah, for all my travels moving away from Detroit and talking to other sports fans around the country, I think everyone's surprised to find out that Detroit's actually a football town. It's not hockey town. It's not the Pistons. It's actually a football town. But the Lions' lack of success, and that's even putting it nicely, over the last 50 years is just kind of eliminated that possibility from the front of people's minds around the country. But like you said, I think it's a football town that is just waiting for that. Like, we'll take a playoff win or even a home game at this point. So we'll see if that can come true with the new coach. But Bill Shea, I want to thank you for taking the time today to talk to us. Verified on Twitter also. So congratulations on that. Bill_Shea19 on Twitter. Follow him there. And thanks for taking the time today.
Hey, thanks for having me. Anytime.
So thanks again to Bill. Check him out on Cranes of Detroit, and also check out my guy Chad Livengood, who I went to Central Michigan with and remain good friends with to this day. He does all the Detroit beat, and so all the development that's going on and everything about the city of Detroit, Chad Livengood's all over that stuff, so follow him as well. Hopefully we'll chase him at some point and get him on Locked On Pistons if he's ever got a story that's got a Pistons angle to it. But we'll be back on Friday, maybe even Thursday night if there's a Pistons move at the trade deadline. But Friday we'll be looking ahead to the weekend, the big Blake versus the Clippers matchup on Friday night. We'll recap the trade deadline around the league as well. But go ahead and follow the Locked On NBA Network on Twitter at Locked On NBA Net. And give us a follow on all of our social media channels, including the new Locked On Pistons-Matt Shook Facebook page as well. But thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks again to Bill Shea. And we'll talk to you all again soon.